Blog Talk Radio.
Koda, Mojuba, Asheda, Mojuba, Aluwa, Mi, Apolabi, Pega, Mojuba, Araba, Mi, Adesanya, Awuyade, Mojuba, Ogute, Compound, Ode, Remo, Mojuba, Baba, Mojuba, Yeye, Mojuba, Egun, to all the God children, Mojuba, Egun, to all the Babalawos, the Ears, Mojuba, Egungun, to all the chiefs, Mojuba, Egungun, to all the Awos, Mojuba, Egungun, to all those that are listening, who are tuned in. We give praise and thanks to the Most High. We say Ashe, 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 Ashe,
Ashe,
Ashe, welcome to Sign of the Times, everyone. This is Queen Tahira. Sign of the Times is brought to you by the UAC and New Power Radio Network. Please find us on Facebook as the UAC New Power Radio Network, Sign of the Times, and myself as Queen Tahira. We also ask that you would please support our sponsors, Manhood, Race, and Culture, headed up by our dear beloved brother, Dr. James Jones. We rocked the house last night. We had a really good dialogue in reference to the legacy and the sacrifice of Malcolm X. And next week we're going to be discussing the formula to success. So we thank Dr. Jones for his continued support to Sign of the Times and to be committed, actually, our second longest co-host next to me. He's been here since day one, so we thank him for his commitment. We also ask that you please support him by visiting Manhood Racing Culture on Facebook as a like and a group page, as well as on the World Wide Web at manhoodraceculture.com. Some wonderful things are going on there, some wonderful things soon to come. And we also ask that you please support Unity Divine. Unity is spelled UNITEE. Please reach out to Arlie Gordon on Facebook as well as on the World Wide Web at unitydesign.com. And again, Unity is spelled UNITEE. Please also check out Unheard Voices on Facebook, and you can email them at unheardvoices78@gmail.com. Doing some wonderful things in reference to representing the unheard voices of our confined citizens, their loved ones, and friends. And never forget the Free Alabama Movement, freealabamamovement.com, and the Free Ohio Movement at freeohiomovement.org. So tonight we have Human Rights Thursdays. Know Your Human Rights Thursdays with our dear sister Elena Porter. I'm going to go ahead and open her up. Peace, sister Elena. How are you doing this evening?
Greetings, sis. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. Fighting a good fight. You know how I do.
I know. I missed you and Dr. Jones last night. I was in and out. I had my grandgirls with me, my grandbabies, and they are a handful.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah,
so
you know I know.
But I did get to listen in, and I really enjoyed the show, and I wish I could have, you know, been able to have a little input in it yesterday. But
that's all right.
Maybe next time.
Your energy came through.
Time.
No worries.
Oh, yeah. Well, tonight we're going to talk about some things that's been happening, you know, lately, you know, recently, you know, on Facebook, in the news. And then we're going to talk about racism and unprincipled relationships. And also we're going to go through a convention, a human rights treaty that can really address racism. It's called the ICERD Treaty. And I'm just going to introduce it and, you know, introduce some high points, you know, of how it can actually be used and assist us. But we're just going to do like a little introduction to that particular treaty tonight.
Okay.
So with that being said, one of the things about the ICERD Treaty is that it's the distinction between dealing with racism in domestic law and international law. For example, in international law, you don't have to prove intent, but in domestic law, you have to prove intent. And also another aspect of racism, the distinction between how racism is dealt with in international law, is the fact that it focuses on the unprincipled relationship, the power issue, as opposed to just like focusing more on the issue with race, you know, the colorism or whatever have you. So you really get to address the meat of racism, the underlying principle, which is a power, issue of power, and how power is distributed. So, sis, what do you think about, you know, that distinction, and how do you think it can help us deal with some of the issues that we go through?
Well, I think the things that we go through are unique to us as a group of people, no matter what people try to say as far as we're all human, you know, we all bleed, those kinds of things. Disproportionately, we've been affected. Our entire existence here on this particular continent, you know, from slavery on, we've never been absolutely free to really have the wealth, riches, and just right to, you know, basic human rights and unalienable rights that we are automatically born with. And should have based on that. And the thing that I like about ICERT is that, you know, with ICERT, you don't need the civil rights, you know, like we have them described here in the U.S. because they're so comprehensive on, you know, what accommodations you can have, what things that you deserve educationally, even housing and things like that. It's really an offshoot of the original Universal Declaration of Human Rights. And it's good that that document, the main document, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, has remained as fluid to where when there is something that needs to be addressed that may need clarity, they've gone out of their way as a universal and international group to look at it and address it. You know, all the things, all the way from mass incarceration to, you know, the things that I just spoke on. So, yeah, I think it's an opportunity for us to empower ourselves with information that, you know, for generations we've always had at our fingertips. We just haven't, formulated a strategy, a formula to success, if you will, to borrow from Dr. Jones, that's working. So, I think it would be good for folks to read it and look at it and realize that all this information is here for our youth, and I yield.
Yes, sis. And other thing I'd like to, add is that there's a wide range of rights that we as African Americans, we have not been exposed to that can really, change the dynamics and change, change the way that we do things and the way that we look at things. With ICERT, we always look at, this quota. We always looked at, thought of racial justice as having a quota, a number of this or a number of that, and we thought that would close the gaps. But ICERT allows us to address, the design, what actually go to the root of the racism. It goes to the power issue of it. And yes, when we say the power issue, and because of who we are, we've been put in a position, in the lower position here in the United States because of who we are as Africans, who we are as a melanin-dominated people. That's why we are where we are. But at the underlying root of it is a power issue. And to address it, we have to understand the design and how the power is distributed. Because if we look at, like, our last presidency with Obama, we equated him being in the White House with power. But him being there, we really didn't obtain any more power than we had in 1865. You know, we were basically economically in the same place when you look at us, in terms of land rights. And or, in terms of economics or whatever have you, or controlling different institutions in our communities. So that is why pretty much I really wanted to focus on ICERT and introduce it to our audience. So with that being said, sis, I'll go ahead and start reading through the convention itself. The International Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Racial Discrimination of 1965. The International Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Racial Discrimination was adopted by the United Nations General Assembly on December 21, 1965, and entered into force on January 4, 1969. As of April 8, 2002, it had 161 states. And state parties. The convention established a committee on the elimination of racial discrimination with monitors, which monitors the implementation of the convention. The committee adopts, when necessary, general recommendations concerning specific articles or issues of special interest. These recommendations will be referred to whenever relevant. Now, as we've always stated on almost every show when we talk about each human rights convention, each convention has a committee where you could submit different communications. So if you ever have an issue that you feel that you need to take a step further or, you know, pursue another avenue, you can always communicate in writing with that commission of that particular convention. So, you know, we've always discussed that, and I just wanted to, you know, point that out. You know, it doesn't matter whether or not it's a police brutality case. If it's a police brutality case, you may want to consider sending it to, there's a convention on torture and cruel, inhumane punishment that has a convention. So one may, you know, want to pursue a communication that way. So when you look at these different, you know, conventions that we're talking about, if it's applicable, you can utilize it. Okay. Now, we're going to go to the undertakings of the state parties. For the purposes of the convention, the term racial discrimination shall mean any distinction, exclusion, restriction, or preferred base on or preference based on race, color, descent, or national or ethnic origin, which has the purpose or effect of nullifying or impairing the recognition, enjoyment, or exercise of an equal footing of human rights and fundamental freedoms in the political, economic, social, cultural, or any other field of public life. Article 1, paragraph 1, emphasis added, however, special measures taken for the sole purpose of securing adequate advancement of certain racial or ethnic groups or individuals in order to ensure such groups or individuals equal enjoyment or exercise of human rights and fundamental freedoms shall not be deemed racial discrimination, provided that they do not lead to the maintenance of separate rights for different racial groups and that they shall not be continued after the objectives for which they were taken have been achieved. So that means that there can be special measures, sis, put in place for different communities, whether it be on a local, state, or federal level, to close gaps, to close disparities. And we suffer from a lot of disparities because we don't utilize this particular tool. We don't enforce this, you know, this part of law, which is a treaty, which it should be enforced here in the United States, but we don't advocate for it to be enforced because we don't know about it, and we don't know about what you don't know about. You don't get any remedy. So do you understand what I'm saying, sis? Where I'm kind of trying to go with this?
Absolutely.
So and I'm just throwing this out there because every day we're fighting, whether it's a traffic ticket, whether it's, you know, you disagree with any service. You know, we have all of these issues that we come up against every day. But we fight them using these old modalities, using these old tactics. So it's just time that, you know, time for us to upgrade a little bit, time for us to pursue other avenues. And it doesn't matter whether it's a big blown-out case. It doesn't matter whether it's a small case, something as small as a traffic ticket. You have a voice. We have brains. We know how to read. We know how to research. We know how to write. We know how to communicate orally. We know how to communicate in, you know, in written form. So we can take these tools that's available to us, sis, and we can use those. So that's where I want to go tonight when I'm talking about this particular treaty. That's why I want to spend a little bit of time just introducing it to the, you know, to the audience. So when we ask, you know, for a different curricula, you know, that's more African-centered, we have that right. We're not being racist, sis. That's just something that we have a right to demand, and we have a right, you know, for it to be funded, and we have a right, you know, to have these things put in place. We don't have to be ashamed because other oppressed groups ask for these things. But because we're not, you know, we're not privy to international law, and we haven't been exposed to this kind of information, we go along to get along. We co-sign on stuff that's detrimental to us, you know. And suffering from a lack of knowledge is costing us. We're paying for it every day, every single day. So with that being said, I'm going to move on. Now, the state parties to the convention condemn racial discrimination and undertake to pursue by all appropriate means and without delay a policy of eliminating racial discrimination in all of its forms and promoting understanding among all races. Article 2, paragraph 1. To this end, they shall undertake in particular to engage in no act or practice of racial discrimination against persons, groups of persons, or institutions, and to ensure that all public authorities and public institutions, national and local, shall act in conformity with this obligation. Article 2, paragraph 1, section 8. Not to sponsor, defend, or support racial discrimination by any persons or organizations. Article 2, paragraph 1, section B. To take effective measures to review public policies at all levels and to amend legislation which has the effect of creating or perpetuating racial discrimination wherever it exists. Article 2, paragraph 1, section C. I want to just stay on this a little bit. You know, in a lot of these police brutality cases, whether it's in corrections where our brothers and sisters are locked up and really don't have anybody to advocate for them, you know, in the school system, you know, where you see this systemic institutionalized racism, whether it's the disparity in putting students in special needs classes or disparity, you know, a lot of times you got to prove intent in domestic law. But I want to stress, in international, in human rights law, you don't have to prove intent. You just have to show evidence that the disparity is there. And to support that, it's right here in this treaty. So, sis, what do you think about that, and how do you think we can use this, you know, and you know, on, you know, from a grassroots perspective? Do you think it's feasible? What do you think about it?
Well, it just makes, you know, human and common sense to me, Sister Elena.
Mm-hmm.
And the more we know, the more we owe ourselves and the future generations to actually implement the things that we're learning. So I think that it's awesome, and I think it should be put to use right now to save ourselves.
So, you know, it's good to just put it out there. And, you know, we don't know who's listening, and we don't know who they have to advocate for them. And they may have to end up doing it themselves. However, I just hope that they take this particular information and go online and research this treaty, you know, for themselves, and really focus on intent and the distinction of intent and how it applies in international and human rights law. And I'm going to move on. Okay. So I'm going to go back over what I just read. To take effective measures to review public policies at all levels and to amend legislation which has the effect of creating or perpetuating racial discrimination wherever it exists. And that is Article 2, paragraph 1, section C. To prohibit and bring to an end by all appropriate means racial discrimination by any person's group or organization. Article 2, paragraph 1, section D. To encourage, where appropriate, integrationist multiracial organizations and movements and other means of eliminating barriers between races, and to discourage anything which tends to strengthen racial division. Article 2, paragraph 1, section E. The state parties shall further assure to everyone within their jurisdiction effective protection and remedies against acts violating a person's human rights contrary to the convention, as well as the right to seek from domestic tribunals just and adequate reparation or satisfaction for any damage suffered as a result of such discrimination. Article 6. Lastly, they undertake in particular to adopt immediate and effective measures, particularly in the fields of teaching, education, culture, and information, with a view to combating prejudice with which lead to racial discrimination. Article 7. So these are some of the things that ICERT has to offer. There's a lot of avenues you can pursue if you are ever discriminated against, if you ever felt like you were violated based on your status, based on your religion or anything, your gender or whatever. You can utilize that treaty. There's a commission that you can send different communications to. So please look this treaty up. Please familiarize yourself with it and share it amongst your friends and family. And I yield the floor.
Ashe, we're going to take the rest of the broadcast to have the opportunity to listen and learn a little bit further. We're going to deal with natural law and unalienable rights. You're listening to Sign of the Times Blog Talk Radio, brought to you by the New Power Radio Network and the United African Coalition for Justice and Human Rights. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody.
Good night.
This is Canada News Libre.
Do not let the hero in your soul perish in lonely frustration for the life you deserve but have never been able to reach. Check your road and the nature of your battle. The world you desired can be won. It exists. It is real. It is possible. It's yours. Fight for the value of your person. Fight for the virtue of your pride. Fight for the essence of that which is man, for his sovereign, rational mind. Fight with the radiant certainty and the absolute rectitude of knowing that yours is the morality of life, and that yours is the battle for any achievement, any value, any grandeur, any goodness, any joy that has ever existed on this earth.
Human rights is, that's a good question.
Human rights. Well, that's tough.
Wow.
I don't even know how to give that a definition.
I would probably have to do a little bit of homework or something.
Any right that I think any, just as a normal, you know, human, any.
The rights that humans have?
Oh, that's a very large debate.
Me hace la semántica.
Tú le puedes preguntar a 20 personas y te van a dar 20 diferentes opiniones.
No sabrei, una domanda complicatissima.
Yeah, we just take them for granted that they're there, but we don't even consider what they are.
The term individual rights is a redundancy. There is no other kind of rights and no one else to possess them.
People don't know their rights and their freedoms anymore. We're not taught these things. They're almost like foreign concepts.
But human rights are the only ones that apply to absolutely everyone, everywhere. That means kids, old people, poor people, basketball players, garbage men, rappers, teachers, Africans, Indians, Albanians, Christians, Muslims, Kabbalists, atheists, your mom, your dad, your next door neighbor, and you all have the exact same human rights. In other words, they're universal. But the question remains, what are they?
There is only one fundamental right, All the others are its consequences or corollaries. A man's right to his own life. Life is a process of self-sustaining and self-generated action. The right to life means the right to engage in self-sustaining and self-generated action, which means the freedom to take all the actions required by the nature of a rational being for the support, the furtherance, the fulfillment, and the enjoyment of his own life. Such is the meaning of the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness.
John Locke was an English philosopher and physician, who is regarded as one of the most influential of Enlightenment thinkers, and known as the father of classical liberalism. A professor at Harvard, Michael Sandel, has said,
John Locke believes that there are certain fundamental individual rights that are so important that no government, even a democratically elected government, can override them. Not only that, he believes that those fundamental rights include a natural right to life, liberty, and property. And furthermore, he argues that the right to property is not just the creation of government or of law. The right to property is a natural right in the sense that it is pre-political. It is a right that attaches to individuals as human beings, even before government comes on the scene, even before parliaments and legislatures enact laws to define rights and to enforce them. Locke says in order to think about what it means to have a natural right, we have to imagine the way things are before government.
The right to life is the source of all rights, and the right to property is their only implementation. Without property rights, no other rights are possible. Since man has to sustain his life by his own effort, the man who has no right to the product of his effort has no means to sustain his life. The man who produces while others dispose of his product is a slave.
At first, there were no human rights. If you were in with the right crowd, you were safe. If you weren't, well, you weren't. But then a guy named Cyrus the Great decided to change all that. After conquering Babylon, he did something completely revolutionary. He announced that all slaves were free to go. He also said people had the freedom to choose their religion, no matter what crowd they were a part of. They documented his words on a clay tablet known as the Cyrus Cylinder. And just like that, human rights were born. The idea spread quickly to Greece, to India, and eventually to Rome. They noticed that people naturally followed certain laws, even if they weren't told to. They called this natural law, but it kept getting trampled on by those in power. Not until 1,000 years later in England did they finally get a king to agree that no one can overrule the rights of people, not even a king. People's rights were finally recognized, and they were now safe from those in power. Kind of. It still took a bunch of British rebels declaring their independence before the king got the point that all men are created equal. Which isn't to say he liked the idea, but he couldn't stop them, and America was born. The French immediately followed with their own revolution for their own rights. Their list was even longer, and they insisted that these rights weren't just made up. They were natural. The Roman concept of natural law had become natural right. Unfortunately, not everyone was so thrilled.
The man who refuses to submit and to serve, Howard Roark, is the man who must be destroyed.
Bear in mind that the right to property is a right to action like all the others. It is not the right to an object, but to the action and the consequences of producing or earning that object. It is not a guarantee that a man will earn any property, but only a guarantee that he will own it if he earns it. It is the right to gain, to keep, to use, and to dispose of material values. To violate man's rights means to compel him to act against his own judgment or to expropriate his values. Basically, there is only one way to do it, by the use of physical force. There are two potential violators of man's rights, the criminals and the government. The great achievement of the United States was to draw a distinction between these two by forbidding to the second the legalized version of the activities of the first. The Declaration of Independence laid down the principle that, to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men. This provided the only valid justification of a government and defined its only proper purpose, to protect man's rights by protecting him from physical violence. Thus, the government's function was changed from the role of ruler to the role of servant. The government was set to protect man from criminals, and the Constitution was written to protect man from the government. The Bill of Rights was not directed against private citizens, but against the government, as an explicit declaration that individual rights supersede any public or social power.
The Bill of Rights guaranteed that the government could not on its own assault your natural rights. Among them, that quintessentially American right, the right to be left alone. Notice also how the Bill of Rights takes a natural law approach to our liberties. It doesn't grant us freedoms, it protects freedoms that are given to us at birth. Listen to the language of the Bill of Rights. Congress shall make no law prohibiting. Congress, political law, may not abridge or infringe. Wording like this simply means that politicians may not prohibit or abridge or infringe upon pre-existing rights. The Bill of Rights does not grant these rights because no human instrument, not even the Constitution, has the power to grant those rights. They pre-exist. They are inherent. They are, in fact, unalienable. You see, if people do not have any unalienable rights, then they have no protection at all from any political law. The king or the sultan or the czar or even the majority in a freely elected Congress determine what laws people will have to live under, which they may employ by force and without any consent. It's all arbitrary, and since it doesn't come from a higher authority, it can be modified at any time. And frankly, if people really can't be trusted with liberty and self-government, then probably the more laws the better. But if we are in fact born free, then the question isn't how many laws we need, but how few. What is the fewest number of laws that free people need? Well, it turns out they just need two. First, do all that you agreed to do. Second, do not encroach upon other persons or their property. Now, do all that you agreed to do is the basis for contract law. Do not encroach on other persons or their property is the basis for all criminal law or tort law, in other words, private lawsuits. Thomas Jefferson said that rightful liberty is unobstructed action according to our will, with limits drawn around us by the equal rights of others. Unobstructed action according to our will means you can do whatever you darn well want to. You are a free person, but your freedom of action ends when other people or their property are harmed by your actions. It's just that simple. That's all you really need.
Locke says the state of nature is the state of liberty. Human beings are free and equal beings. There is no natural hierarchy. It's not the case that some people are born to be kings and others were born to be serfs. We're free and equal in the state of nature. Unalienable rights, rights that are so essentially mine that even I can't trade them away or give them up. So, these are the rights we have in the state of nature before there is any government. In the case of life and liberty, I can't take my own life, I can't sell myself into slavery, any more than I can take somebody else's life or take someone else as a slave by force. Alongside the whole story about consent and majority rule, there are these natural rights, the law of nature, these inalienable rights. They don't disappear when people join together to create a civil society. So even once the majority is in charge, the majority can't violate your unalienable rights, can't violate your fundamental right to life, liberty, and property. For John Locke, the law of nature persists once government arrived. Government is limited by the end for which it was created, namely, the preservation of property. No parliament, no legislature, however democratic its credentials, can legitimately violate our natural rights. The government can't take your property without your consent. Locke is clear about that.
Rights are a moral concept, the concept that provides a logical transition from the principles guiding an individual's actions to the principles guiding his relationship with others. Individual rights are the means of subordinating society to moral law. Every political system is based on some code of ethics. The dominant ethics of mankind's history were variants of the altruist collectivist doctrine, which subordinated the individual to some higher authority, either mystical or social. Consequently, most political systems were variants of the same statist tyranny, differing only in degree, not in basic principle, limited only by the accidents of tradition, of chaos, of bloody strife and periodic collapse. Under all such systems, morality was a code applicable to the individual but not to society. Society was placed outside the moral law as its embodiment or source or exclusive interpreter. Since there is no such entity as society, since society is only a number of individual men, this meant, in practice, that the rulers of society were exempt from moral law. Subject only to traditional rituals, they held total power and exacted blind obedience, on the implicit principle of the good is that which is good for society, or for the tribe, the race, the nation, and the ruler's edicts are its voice on earth. This was true of all statist systems, under all variants of the altruist collectivist ethics, mystical or social. As witness, the theocracy of Egypt, with the pharaoh as an embodied god. The unlimited majority rule or democracy of Athens. The welfare state run by the emperors of Rome. The Inquisition of the late Middle Ages. The gas chambers of Nazi Germany. The slaughterhouse of the Soviet Union. All these political systems were expressions of the altruist collectivist ethics, and their common characteristic is the fact that society stood above the moral law as an omnipotent sovereign whim worshiper. The most profoundly revolutionary achievement of the United States of America was the subordination of society to moral law. The principle of man's individual rights represented the extension of morality into the social system, as a limitation on the power of the state, as man's protection against the brute force of the collective, as the subordination of might to right. All previous systems had regarded man as a sacrificial means to the ends of others, and society as an end in itself. The United States regarded man as an end in himself, and society as a means to the peaceful, orderly, voluntary coexistence of individuals. All previous systems had held that man's life belongs to society, that society can dispose of him in any way it pleases, and that any freedom he enjoys is his only by favor, by the permission of society, which may be revoked at any time. The United States held that man's life is his by right, which means by moral principle and by his nature, that a right is the property of an individual, that society as such has no rights, and that the only moral purpose of a government is the protection of individual rights.
Now, the United States of America is the first, and as far as I know, the only country in the history of the world to be founded on natural law. The Declaration of Independence was an appeal to the world, an appeal to overthrow the corrupt political law of King George and invoke a higher law, natural law, as justification for this action. Probably the most definitive sentence ever written on natural law, certainly the most famous sentence, is this one. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. What a sentence. First, we hold these truths, not these opinions, not these agreements, not this consensus, not this vote, these truths, fundamental realities that any person in any culture can reason out for himself. To be self-evident, that means we didn't write them, we didn't create them, we don't allow them or grant them permission. They are self-evident because they were here before we were. That all men are created equal, obviously not equally rich or equally smart or equally tall or equally fast, but equal under the law, which applies to the rich and powerful as well as to the poor and friendless. That they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights. Now, for people who believe in God, this is self-explanatory, but even people who do not believe in God need to believe in this, that each human has, as his birthright, certain rights that cannot be taken away, and that these rights are bestowed upon us not by people, not by governments, but by a force far greater than people or government. You could call it history, call it human evolution, call it justice, but whatever it is beyond the reach of mortal men and women. That among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness.
It's easy to forget how radically new an idea America is. The founding fathers invented a new form of government. All previous forms of government had concentrated power into the hands of the state at the expense of the individual. Theocracy placed power into the hands of priests and popes, who, as spokesmen for the supernatural, were to be obeyed without question. Monarchy placed power into the hands of a king or a queen, whose subjects lived and died by the ruler's edicts. Democracy placed power into the hands of the majority, who could do whatever they wished to the minority. In all these systems, recalcitrant individuals were dealt with in the same way. They were greeted with the instruments of physical compulsion, with imprisonment, torture, death. To all such outrages, the founding fathers said no more. They devised a political system that placed power into the hands of the individual at the expense of the state. The government does not stand above the individual as his master. The government stands below the individual as its servant.
The reasoning mind cannot work under any form of compulsion. It cannot be subordinated to the needs, opinions, or wishes of others. It is not an object of sacrifice. The Creator stands on his own judgment. The parasite follows the opinions of others. The Creator thinks. The parasite copies. The Creator produces. The parasite loots. The Creator's concern is the conquest of nature. The parasite's concern is the conquest of man. The Creator requires independence. He neither serves nor rules. He deals with men by free exchange and voluntary choice. The parasite seeks power. He wants to bind all men together in common action and common slavery. He claims that man is only a tool for the use of others, that he must think as they think, act as they act, and live in selfless, joyless servitude to any need but his own. Look at history. Everything we have, every great achievement, has come from the independent work of some independent mind. Every horror and destruction came from attempts to force men into a herd of brainless, soulless robots, without personal rights, without personal ambition, without will, hope, or dignity. It is an ancient conflict. It has another name: the individual against the collective. Our country, the noblest country in the history of men, was based on the principle of individualism, the principle of man's inalienable rights. It was a country where a man was free to seek his own happiness, to gain and produce, not to give up and renounce, to prosper, not to starve, to achieve, not to plunder, to hold as his highest possession a sense of his personal value, and as his highest virtue, his self-respect. Look at the results. That is what the collectivists are now asking you to destroy, as much of the earth has been destroyed. I am an architect. I know what is to come by the principle on which it is built. We are approaching a world in which I cannot permit myself to live. My ideas are my property. They were taken from me by force, by breach of contract. No appeal was left to me. It was believed that my work belonged to others to do with as they pleased. They had a claim upon me without my consent, that it was my duty to serve them without choice or reward. I came here to say that I do not recognize anyone's right to 1 minute of my life, nor to any part of my energy, nor to any achievement of mine, no matter who makes the claim. It had to be said. The world is perishing from an orgy of self-sacrificing. I came here to be heard in the name of every man of independence still left in the world. I wanted to state my terms. I do not care to work or live on any others. My terms are a man's right to exist for his own sake.
What does it mean to own something? It means that you and you alone have the right to decide what is done with that thing. What is yours, you can use, you can trade, you can give away, you can destroy. So what does it mean to say you own yourself? It means that you and you alone have the right to decide what is done with your body and your mind, with your time and your energy. If someone else had the right to decide what is done with your body and your mind, your time and your energy, then he would be your owner and you would be his slave. So, are you anyone's slave? Do you pay taxes? Do you feel obligated to obey whatever the politicians decide to call law? Do you imagine that someone else has the right to control you, to rule you? Do you vote? In every political election, you are asked to decide who you want owning you, but owning yourself is never one of the options offered. The only choice you are given is the choice of which politicians will coerce and control you by way of so-called regulation and legislation, and confiscate what you produce by way of taxation. Whoever wins, you will be extorted and dominated. When you vote, whether you win or not, you are accepting that someone else has the right to rule you. You are conceding the state's authority over you. You are agreeing that you are going to be someone's slave, with the only question being which political master will own you. If you believe that you have an obligation to pay taxes, if you concede that it is up to someone else to decide how much of your earnings they will let you keep, then you are their slave. If you own yourself, you don't need the permission of anyone, any individual, any group, any collective, any country, any legislature, to run your own life, make your own choices, and keep the fruits of your own labor.
So, your rights are property. That's very, very important to understand. Very important to understand. Rights that are your property for your exclusive use. Now, those rights are yours for your exclusive use. Okay? Unalienable. Unalienable means that they cannot be removed from you without altering what you are. Okay? They're unalienable. Again, property. People have a misconception of what property is. Again, don't take my word for it. I mean, that's a simple definition. Anybody can look that up in Black's Law Dictionary. It's not in a statute. That's what the actual word means. Not my opinion. Property. That which is peculiar or proper to any person. That which belongs exclusively to one. In the strict legal sense, an aggregate of rights which are guaranteed and protected by the government. Yeah, we can get into that. The term is said to extend to every species of valuable right and interest. We don't really need to get much beyond that to start painting in more holes in the picture here. So, if it is and extends to every species of valuable right and interest, now we know that I'm equal to everybody else, I have equal rights, and those rights are my property. Your rights are yours, no different than an arm or a leg. They're a part of you. They're indistinguishable, whether they're physical or not. It's still something you possess. It is your property. And no one has any right to it but you. And that harms you if that has been denied to you. Because, again, who has the authority to deny that to you? But, well, we're only talking about rights right now, so that'd be your creator, the God of nature. He's the only one that can do that. The act of removing it harms you, causes an injury, which is a loss. That loss is a cause of action. And that's very important because when people want to start going back for remedy and recourse here right away, and we're going to get more involved into this too. But because all of these things cannot be denied to you without that party causing you harm and you having a cause of action, they had to figure out a way to get around all of that and not just come right out and enslave you the way they used to, you know, 100 years ago. So there's a new form of slavery. It's word slavery, mind slavery. If they can convince you of certain truths, then they haven't harmed you, because you did it to yourself. You went and you accepted their offer to be recognized as a legal person or a human being in their system. Now, a lot of people have come to me in the past, and I've never, ever been big on the UN Declaration of Human Rights. I'll quote it at times. I'll say, well, you know, even they agree that as a human being, I have that right. Now, the problem is I don't even like the word human being at all. And it wasn't until I actually showed somebody the reason why the other day that they couldn't believe it. And, well, let me ask everybody, do you all have human rights?
Natural rights.
Oh, natural rights. That's a better word. Okay, everybody wants human rights because, man, they've made international charters on this. You got the right to be a human being. That's great. And my answer to that is, when was the last time the United Nations did something that was genuinely good for any of the people on this planet? Never. Never. But they just, in all their benevolence, decided they were going to grant you these rights as a human being. A human being is an artificial person. Persons are divided by the law into either natural persons or artificial. Natural persons are such as the God of nature formed us. That's very succinct. I like that. There's no further explanation. That's it. Natural persons are such as the God of nature formed us, with all my unalienable rights intact. Artificial are such as created and devised by human laws for the purposes of society and government, which are called corporations or bodies politic. Okay? So, that's what the legal person is. The legal person, or human being, which are one and the same, they are both a body politic. The UN is a body politic. What else could it recognize but other body politics? Another political body. They're a political organization. What else could they recognize? You think they're recognizing the rights of man as created by the God of nature? Nope. All part of the illusion. You can't go after remedy if you don't even know what your rights are, because then you cannot express a proper cause of action. That's why you're kept ignorant.
Got a serious situation going on. Certainly is not a stretch of the imagination to think that somebody like Dean Clifford would be targeted. Do you think it's likely that they're trying to set an example or silence somebody such as Dean?
It seems strange to me that he would go to jail for so long that it would unfold in this manner over a simple driving, even if it was an infraction. He is notoriously known as a political activist and an advocate of change in government. So it's not a far stretch to believe that this judicial system is being abused by a few people in order to punish him for his views and his being vocal about it. So that wouldn't surprise me. I don't know. I think they're getting scared. I think they're starting to realize that people are sick and tired of their abuse of power and authority,
hey,
and people
are
saying no to it. I mean, they're stupid to try this stuff in Canada. I mean, I've been all over Canada. I know your average Canadian. We tend to be very laissez-faire and very easygoing, but once you cross a line, that's it. And I think a lot of people are realizing the people in the government, the bankers, the politicians, and the cops, they all think they're above the law and that we're their chattel property. They've used deception to get us into a position of ward of the state underneath them, when we should be masters over our servants, and the chickens are coming home to roost, eh?
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, you're not going to be able to silence it, because people, once they see it, they see it, and once you've seen it, you can't unsee it,
further
supports our belief in it. So, I mean, they've got to come up with something besides the old ways of dealing with this dissent. I mean, it's the boots and the claim of the crown, and oh, I have divine authority and I have the guns. It's not working anymore.
Potentially, a government is the most dangerous threat to man's rights. It holds a legal monopoly on the use of physical force against legally disarmed victims. When unlimited and unrestricted by individual rights, a government is men's deadliest enemy.
Political law is simply the law as written by individuals. It varies with the whims of the individuals that wrote it. It is arbitrary. It is constantly changing, and it is therefore unpredictable. People with political power write political law.
Power by nature expands. That's why we have a constitution, to restrain governmental power. Who would want to live in a society where the government was unrestrained? Have we fought wars against totalitarian governments only to find that we have elected one here at home?
Somewhere a perversion has taken place. Our natural unalienable rights are now considered to be a dispensation of government. And freedom has never been so fragile, so close to slipping from our grasp as it is at this moment.
What if voting didn't mean anything anymore because both political parties stand for big government? What if the government could write any law, regulate any behavior, and tax any event? The Constitution be damned. What if the government was the reason we don't have a constitution anymore? What if you could love your country but hate what the government has done to it? What if sometimes, to love your country, you had to alter or abolish the government? What if Jefferson was right? What if that government is best which governs least? What if I'm right? What if the government is wrong? What if it is dangerous to be right when the government is wrong? What if it is better to perish fighting for freedom than to live as a slave? What if freedom's greatest hour of danger is now? Have we become a nation of sheep? Sadly, the answers to these questions are obvious.
Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Thompson, your president, will not be speaking with you tonight. His time is up. I have taken it over. You were to hear a report on the world crisis. That is what you are going to hear. For 12 years, you have been asking, who is John Galt? This is John Galt speaking. I am the man who loves his life. I am the man who does not sacrifice his love or his values. 12 years ago, when I worked in your world, I was an inventor, like the man who discovered the use of steam or the man who discovered the use of oil. I discovered a source of energy which had been available since the birth of the globe, but which men had not known how to use except as an object of worship, of terror, and of legends without a thundering god. I invented a motor that draws its energy from the atmosphere, a perpetually running motor. It would have raised the efficiency of every human installation using power. It would have made a fortune for me and for those who had hired me. Then one night at a factory meeting, I heard myself sentenced to death by reason of my achievement. I heard three parasites assert that my brain and my life were their property, that my right to exist was conditional and dependent upon the satisfaction of their desires. The purpose of my ability, they said, was to serve the needs of those who were less able. Just as the parasites were counting on my self-immolation to carry out the means of their plan, so throughout the world and throughout men's history in every version and form, I saw I could put an end to your outrages by pronouncing a single word in my mind. I pronounced it. The word was no.
It was the concept of individual rights that had given birth to a free society. It was with the destruction of individual rights that the destruction of freedom had to begin. A collectivist tyranny dare not enslave a country by an outright confiscation of its values, material or moral. It has to be done by a process of internal corruption. Just as in the material realm, the plundering of a country's wealth is accomplished by inflating the currency, So today one may witness the process of inflation being applied to the realm of rights. The process entails such a growth of newly promulgated rights that people do not notice the fact that the meaning of the concept is being reversed. Just as bad money drives out good money, so these printing press rights negate authentic rights.
As long as the politicians see you voting, petitioning, protesting, and campaigning, begging for tax cuts, whining for different legislation, as long as they see you timidly obeying whatever commands they issue while begging them to change their so-called laws, then they know that they own you in mind and body. The slave master doesn't mind his slaves pitifully begging for mercy, as long as they keep obeying and keep producing wealth for the master to steal. Those in power aren't worried about elections or petitions. What they do fear is that one day their victims will realize the truth, will stop believing in the divine right of politicians, will stop believing that anyone has the right to rule them, will stop imagining authority where there is none, will realize that they own themselves. If you own your time and effort and the fruits of your labor, then stop asking nicely to be allowed to keep it. If you own yourself, then stop asking nicely for legislative permission to run your own life. If you actually believe in unalienable rights, in individual liberty, in freedom, then stop asking nicely for the sociopathic parasites to let you be free. For humanity to be free, people need to stop thinking, talking, and acting like slaves. If you truly understand that you own yourself, then start acting like it.
Whoever you are, you who are alone with my words in this moment, with nothing but your honesty to help you understand, the choice is still open to be a human being, but the price is to start from scratch, to stand naked in the face of reality and reversing a costly historical error to declare, I am. Therefore, I'll think. When you cried in despair for the unattainable spirit which you felt had deserted your world, you gave it my name. But what you were calling was your own betrayed self-esteem. You who've lost the concept of a right. Rights are conditions of existence required by man's nature for his proper survival. If man is to live on earth, it is right for him to use his mind. It is right to act on his own free judgment. It is right to work for his values and to keep the product of his work. If life on earth is his purpose, he has a right to live as a rational being. Nature forbids him the irrational. Any group, any gang, any nation that attempts to negate man's rights is wrong. Only a slave can work with no right to the product of his effort. The only proper purpose of a government is to protect man's rights, which means to protect him from physical violence. A proper government is only a policeman, acting as an agent of man's self-defense, and as such may resort to force only against those who start the use of force. Now that you know the truth about your world, stop supporting your own destroyers. The evil of the world is made possible by nothing but the sanction you give it. Withdraw your sanction. Withdraw your support. Do not try to live on your enemy's terms or to win at a game where they're setting the rules. Do not seek the favor of those who enslaved you. The more you pay them, the more they will demand. The greater the values you seek or achieve, the more vulnerably helpless you become. Do not attempt to rise on the looter's terms or to climb a ladder while they're holding the ropes. Do not allow their hands to touch the only power that keeps them in power, your living ambition. Do not try to produce a fortune with a looter riding on your back. Stay on the lowest rung of their ladder. Earn no more than your barest survival. Do not make an extra penny to support the looter's state. Since you're captive, act as a captive. Do not help them pretend that you're free. Be the silent, incorruptible enemy they dread. When they force you, obey. But do not volunteer. Never volunteer a step in their direction, or a wish, or a plea, or a purpose. Your sanction is their only life. If you find a chance to vanish into some wilderness out of their reach, do so. But not to exist as a bandit or to create a gang competing with their racket. Build a productive life of your own with those who accept your moral code and are willing to struggle for a human existence. You have no chance to win on the morality of death or by the code of faith and force. Raise a standard to which the honest will repair, the standard of life and reason. act as a rational being, and aim at becoming a rallying point for all those who are starved for a voice of integrity. Act on your rational values, whether alone in the midst of your enemies or with a few of your chosen friends, or as the founder of a modest community on the frontier of mankind's rebirth. Such is the future you are capable of winning. Do you wish to continue the battle of your present, or do you wish to fight for my world? Do you wish to continue a struggle that consists of clinging to precarious ledges in a sliding descent to the abyss? Such is the choice before you. Let your mind and your love of existence decide. The last of my words will be addressed to those heroes who might still be hidden in the world, those who are held prisoner not by their evasions, but by their virtues and their desperate courage. My brothers in spirit, check on your virtues and on the nature of the enemies you're serving. Your destroyers hold you by means of your endurance, your generosity, your innocence, your love. Do not let the hero in your soul perish in lonely frustration for the life you deserve, but have never been able to reach. Check your mode and the nature of your battle. The world you desired can be won. It exists, it is real, it is possible. It's yours. Fight for the value of your person. Fight for the virtue of your pride. Fight for the essence of that which is man, for his sovereign, rational mind. Fight with the radiant certainty and the absolute rectitude of knowing that yours is the morality of life, and that yours is the battle for any achievement, any value, any grandeur, any goodness, any joy that has ever existed on this earth. You will win when you are ready to pronounce the oath I have taken at the start of my battle. And for those who wish to know the day of my return, I shall now repeat it to the hearing of the world. I swear by my life and my love of it, that I will never live for the sake of another man, nor ask another man to live for mine.
Earth, and there's more black people on earth than there are white people. going on this earth right now that he's involved in. Tell me where he's winning. Nowhere. Why, some race farmers, some race eaters ran him out of Korea. Yes, they ran him out of Korea. Race eaters with nothing but gym shoes and a rifle and a bowl of rice. Took him and his tanks and his napalm and all that other action he's supposed to have and ran him across the Yalu. Why? Because the day that he can win on the ground is past. Up in French Indochina, those little peasants, race growers, took on the might of the French army and ran all the Frenchmen. You remember Dien Bien Phu? No! The same thing happened in Algeria, in Africa. They didn't have anything but a rifle. The French had all these highly mechanized instruments of warfare. But they put some guerrilla action on them. And a white man can't fight a guerrilla warfare. Guerrilla action takes heart, takes nerve, and he doesn't have that.
This is from the pamphlet, 25 Years a Slave, a Pennsylvania prisoner's appeal to the people for freedom. This is entitled The Letter to the People by Asafo Chuma Asafo from Huntington Penitentiary in Pennsylvania, USA. Dear people, I am speaking these words to y'all from the confines of one of Pennsylvania's most dreadful neo-plantations. But with an untethered heart and an unchained mind, and in the flesh and spirit of my true African self, and not as the colonial subject my captors wishes me to be, with a solemn meditation that my honorable ancestors will guide my voice and aid in the escape of these words, smuggling them not only past these cell bars, barbed wire fences, gun towers, and state-hired goons, but also the artificial barriers, stigmas, and stereotypes constructed by today's slave makers to maintain their age-old tactic of divide and conquer as it pertains to their efforts to cut the modern-day enslaved off from the rest of the world, especially from you, the people. I am, again, Asafo Chuma Asafo. However, on all government paperwork relevant to my incarceration / enslavement and other state documents, I am known by the colonial name Robert Williams, a name I have openly denounced in favor of the former. I have been in state captivity for more than 25 years on a trumped-up second-degree murder conviction. I was 19 years old when I was captured, charged, and led away in chains by the modern paddy rollers and subjected to one state internment camp after another, where I have pretty much grown up. I never got the chance to experience a quote-unquote normal life, including one of the most fundamental tenets of being human, which is to have children. With the exception of a fistful of committed family and friends, I have grown accustomed to people bouncing in and out of my life with no real permanence, a precarious circumstance no doubt attributed to my protracted captivity. People, these words aren't to elicit any undue pity, nor are they an attempt to paint myself with the brush of a saint. My formative years were honed in the streets of Philadelphia, replete with all of their dirty elements. So much of what the streets say I did, I'll be the first to affirm. In the words and spirit of honorable ancestor Amilcar Cabral, quote, mask no difficulties, claim no easy victories, and tell no lies to the people, end quote. So I come to you with both hands exposed, palms up, with remnants of grit still in the cracks. But I assure you, I still have my honor, my integrity, and more importantly, my African soul. And to the dismay of my captors, I have been redeemed by Malcolm X, Elijah Muhammad, Queen Mother Moore, Dr. Amos Wilson, and ilk. I would like to read to you an excerpt from the book entitled Slavery Here and Now. Contrary to popular belief that the Emancipation Proclamation of 1863 actually ended slavery for Africans here in North America, it has not. And although it has taken on more subtle variations to suit the changing times and trends, an honest examination of the enduring powerless lot of African peoples would certainly lend credence to the familiar maxim, the more things change, the more they remain the same. Sure, the chains were removed from the hands and feet of captured Africans, but they were ultimately placed on their minds, thus choreographing their prescribed behavior within the broader American society. However, when it comes to the mass incarceration of African men, women, and children within what has become widely referred to as the prison industrial complex, we see the continuum of chattel slavery, concealed, of course, behind the rubric of crime and punishment. The term criminal itself is a loaded handle, wielded by white power holders to perpetuate the imprisonment or enslavement of Africans, enshrined within his more ubiquitous phrase, law and order, a phrase interpreted by many of us Africans in the context of its dual functioning as it adversely affects us versus European Americans to mean our systematic entrapment. And given what Earl O'Farrell Hutchison has so fittingly termed, and I quote, the assassination of the black male image, end quote, by the biased corporate-owned media machine, the spurious social sciences, and the manipulated religious interpretations which painted God in the image of a European while deeming Africans cursed and thus worthy of an eternal status of inferiority, gives us an historical foundation for the ways and means by which the politics of race are being played out in the now times, especially as it pertains to the criminalization of Africans. In her eye-opening treatise, The New Jim Crow, Michelle Alexander very cogently explains how an entire nation of captured Africans can be wantonly, maliciously, and deliberately targeted for mass incarceration and subsequently relegated to a permanent undercaste status here in the land of the free, by laws, statutes, and policies that appear race-neutral on their face, while being enforced in lieu of a sinister political agenda that ultimately serves the aims and objectives of this ivory-coated empire called America, at the expense of those people the white oppressor have always considered to be, in the words of warrior scholar Marimba Ani, the cultural other. In this vein, Alexander's study succeeds in peeling back the veil of color blindness, revealing with empirical data, the bulk of which was gleaned from the state's own archives, not only the racist and biased ways in which the laws are still being applied to the cultural other, but how the state's economy, power dynamics, status quo, much like the Jim Crow era of old, is dependent upon this new version, which we're faced with today, so much so that it cannot turn itself around. It therefore reinvents itself in different guises in an attempt to evade scrutiny while shrouding itself in colorblind rhetoric, which itself is monopolized, that is, framed, controlled, and contextualized by the state in terms of when and how racial matters should be presented, discussed, or handled in the society at large, but especially so within the political law and order realm. But once we decode the Greco-Latin legal jargon and remove the esoteric mask as to how it protects white rule while conversely subjugating African peoples, it reveals the naked face of its hypocrisy. Take, for example, the term emancipate, which is said to mean to set free. However, when traced back to its origins, we learn that it is a term taken from old Roman legalese. It really means transfer of ownership. So African captives were never truly set free. We were merely transferred from private property status to state-owned property, which later became known as assumable jurisdiction. Hell, the emancipator himself, Abraham Lincoln, during his political debates with political opponent, Stephen Douglas, declared, and I quote, "There must be an inferior and a superior. I, as much as any man, am in favor of superior being assigned to the white race," end quote. So when we look at the systematic condemnation, demonization, and subsequent criminalization of Africans through the prism of the double-edged 13th Amendment to the United States Constitution, which reads, and I quote, "Neither slavery nor involuntary servitude, except as a punishment for crime whereof the party shall have been duly convicted, shall exist within the United States or any place subject to their jurisdiction," end quote. It brings into clearer focus the rise and proliferation of the day's new slave plantations, euphemistically called correctional facilities. In fact, it is no empty coincidence that just after the close of the Civil War of April 1865, Africans in America's prisons immediately went from zero to over 30%. African prisoners were then subject to the brutal convict lease system, where force-free prison labor was leased out to plantation owners and other industrial barons, filling the coffers of prison wardens in the state's respective treasuries, an arrangement described in David M. Oshinsky's titled book as Worse Than Slavery. Fast forward to the now times, and as we can see, the three fastest growing industries are the military-industrial complex, the prison-industrial complex, and the surveillance-industrial complex, all working in concert to more efficiently maintain the colonization, surveillance, and imprisonment or enslavement of the ghettos and their African denizens, not excluding poor whites. Each state's court system serves as the new slave owners, a system driven by coded policies with elected politicians performing in the capacity of modern-day slave traders, the police apparatus acting as today's slave hunters or catchers. America's jails and prisons are, of course, the new slave plantations, where forced cheap prison labor is in full force. Prison industrial sweatshops throughout the United States produce everything from car parts to pillowcases and much in between, which are matriculated into the wider consumer market flow at great profits. Prisoners are also sacrificed at the altar of the exploitation at the hands of rapacious private sector profiteers, namely telephone companies, transportation services, prison commissary vendors, money order wire transfer firms, cable companies, etc., 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 with handsome kickbacks paid to the prisonocracy. The Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, a state which holds some 50,000 men, women, and children behind the walls and fences of its new plantations, have a unique history. Being one of the original 13 colonies, it is steeped in the rich tradition of chattel slavery, a tradition that is alive and thriving as we speak. The very emblem on the Commonwealth flag, which flies over every municipal building and every single prison and jail in the state of Pennsylvania and stamped atop all official state charters, is an old and persistent symbol of slavery. It was originally used in the South to identify legitimate auction blocks where European American males sold and traded captured African men, women, and children. It also represented a bill of sales. If you look closely between the two raised horses, you will see a slave ship, which represents the trafficking in human cargo. Just beneath the slave ship is a farm hoe, which signifies the labor of the enslaved on the many plantations as the backbone of the state's economy. The three bales of cotton, wheat, and tobacco represent the principal crops that enrich the slave master society. The eagle or vulture that sits at the very top represents insatiable greed. These emblems or coat of arms are still used today on all uniforms and documents that it continues to perpetuate this modern form of slavery. The Pennsylvania Department of Corrections, or PADOC, the courts, DAs, lawyers, parole and probation, etc., all use the symbol to signify that they are continuing the original plantation business, only in a slightly different and more accepted form. Again, that was a piece by Basafo Chumasafo from the pamphlet 25 Years Enslaved, Pennsylvania Prisoners' Appeal to the People for Freedom. I'd like to thank Patricia Mama Pat Vickers, Teresa Schultz, the Warrior, Sandra the Nahanda Hill, Brett Grote, who is quickly becoming our generation's William Kunstler, and certainly PrisonRadio.org, Noel.
These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.